Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Postpartum Therapist Podcast. I have a very, very special guest with us today. Today, I have invited my self-publishing coach to interview with me. Her name is Carla. I'm so thankful for this recent friendship. Without her, I don't know that my book would have gotten out at all or as soon as it did. I kind of went to her in despair saying, this, and she has been so gracious and devoting so much time and dedication to helping me put out something that was really important. So I'm so thankful to her, to you, Carla. Thank you for joining us. I am so excited for you to share your background with everybody and just to get to know you a little bit more. So if you wouldn't mind, could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you so much, Jasmine, for having me podcast today. And for those that are listening, my name is Carla Marie Williams. I am the wife of Superman for the last 24 years and I'm mom to six amazing kids via adoption. And I am an author of multiple books. I am a international speaker and a homeschool coach to families across the globe. And I wear many hats. One of the hats that I do wear is a trauma competent trainer for foster and adoptive families here in the U.S. as well as multiple countries around the world. And so I'm really excited to be here and to share my perspective on many things today. So again, thank you, Jasmine, for having me.
Yeah, and I am just so excited because I feel like any listener would just want to hear what you have to say. You have such a vast experience with so many different groups, and you know, you have the homeschool, you have the trauma, you have adoption. So I am just so excited for this. So if you don't mind, as it relates kind of to my realm and whatnot, could you share how you even got into adoption? What that experience was like. Would you mind giving us some background about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So my husband and I think one of the things that attracted us to one another was that miraculously we both wanted six children. And I know that's an odd number, but even before we were married, that was the agreement. How, when, what that would entail, we had no idea. But we started the traditional route, as most people do, and that resulted in multiple, as a matter of fact, six pregnancies, seven miscarriages. One was a twin pregnancy. And we came to a realization, actually my husband did, that our goal was to be parents, and there was more than one way to do that. And he came to me and basically said, I can't watch you go through this again. I don't want your body, you know, to have to go through this again. And we need to seek other ways of doing this. And so we began to do our research, and we decided that foster adoption was the right route for us at the time. And because we had waited so long and was so desperate to be parents, we actually got, took our classes and did everything that we needed to do. But we were like, you know what? Just lay it on us. We'll take more than one. And I will back up a little bit as far as the emotional and mental, all of the effects that multiple miscarriages had on not just myself, but my husband as well. There was a lot of despair, a lot of self-loathing and blame, knowing in retrospect that it wasn't my fault, that those were not, you know, things that I caused. But it's hard when you're in the moment to believe that. It's hard to believe that, your own worthiness, why is it that I can't do the very basic thing that our bodies as women are created to do. And that was hard. That was hard stuff to go through. And I had multiple friends and family that were starting their families at that time. And unlike many people that tend to kind of go into a cocoon and shield themselves, I did the opposite. And I think that helped with my healing process, was that I decided to be the one throwing everyone's shower. I decided to be the one, you know, the minute a friend or family member said they were pregnant, I started a basket. And for the entire pregnancy, I just added to it and added to it all of these wonderful things that I could bless the mom and baby and family with. And that helped me. That helped me. Celebrating other people helped me not stay in a self-loathing or a just shut myself off.
Sure. Yeah.
And that helped me. Now, whether or not that will help everybody that goes through something like that, I can't say for sure. But that helped me get out of that funk, so to speak, and focus on the needs of other people. And you know, today I can talk about it without crying. There were many years that I couldn't without, you know, an ugly cry, but I can talk about it. And yeah, I mean, it was a long time. I was not surrounded by a supportive group of people. My immediate friends and my immediate family were supportive, but I was involved in an organization that was not, and they required a lot of time with me. And so just to wrap that part of my life up, I decided that regardless of those that were not supporting me, that I was going to make sure that I supported myself and that I loved on myself and that I told myself the truth about the situation instead of what, you know, lies, like it's your fault, all those kinds of things that try to talk in your ear and make you feel, you know, like you're out of control kind of thing. So I found myself really, really healing, but I had to spearhead that. No one could do that for me. And so that was an interesting time. But moving forward, when we decided to go in the route of foster adoption, we were like, we've been waiting forever. And just lay it on us. And that's exactly what happened. We were the only, you know, waiting family that had determined we would take multiple children. And we received that phone call with two toddlers, and it was an amazing, amazing moment. I just everything came full circle, and suddenly I was going to be a mom of these two beautiful children. And once they came home, about 6 months later, we received a phone call for their little brother, who was a newborn.
Okay. Yes, I'm just smiling over here because I'm thinking, okay, I have two toddlers.
Yeah.
We're going to throw a newborn in there. Okay, I'm listening to her story.
Yeah.
All right, sure.
No, I mean, to be honest, it's all a blur because it was like parenting boot camp. I mean, seriously, having been married 8 years and no children, and then suddenly a three-year-old, a two-year-old, and a newborn, it was quite something. Very excited. Everything was new. It was wonderful. And at the same time, there was something, how can I put it? There were feelings of despair that I didn't really talk about. I didn't really want to share them with my husband because in my mind, I have been waiting to be a mom all this time. How dare I have anything to complain about? How dare I be down? How dare I be sad when everything I've dreamed about was just dropped in my lap? And but I think that I had some moments where I was sad that I wasn't there at the beginning of their lives. I was sad that when I sat with my friends, that as they talked about, you know, birth weight and the exact time that they were born and all of those things. And I have to go actually look at the birth certificate to know all those things, right?
Yeah.
You know, even today, I have to reference paperwork to know the things that other moms know. And that was hard for me, you know, to be at baby showers and everybody's talking about the beginning, you know. And I had no beginning stories. And it made me sad for my kids, but it also made me sad for myself that I didn't experience what other moms had experienced. And so it brought a little, you know, it brought a period of time in my life where I was down, but I couldn't explain it. So I would never approach anyone with the thought, because everything that I dreamed of, I was experiencing. So it wouldn't make sense to anyone else that I had these feelings. And so I kept them to myself. And I did not get help. I didn't talk to anybody about it, because at that time I didn't have anyone around me that had fostered or adopted. I didn't have anyone around me that had experienced the extreme pregnancy issues that I had experienced. And so I felt really alone. My husband's very supportive. He's always been amazing. But he can only understand so much being a male and being a dad. He has a whole nother perspective. And so those are some of the things that happened, you know, immediately following our adoption. I was happy. I was excited. And some would say that those feelings can't happen at the same time, that you can't be down and happy, that you can't be excited and concerned, or that you can't be sad and elated, right?
Right.
And I stood in those two places congruently, and it was hard because I felt selfish and I felt like I didn't have the right to have those feelings.
Yeah. And I've talked to other moms, not so much from foster and adoption perspective, but moms that had struggled with infertility, and then they finally get pregnant and they hate being pregnant. They're so sick and they're so uncomfortable and they feel so guilty, and they just keep it to themselves because, man, I've begged for this. Like you said, how dare I complain? Or when baby arrives, wanting this baby so bad, or maybe trying for years, and I think you could probably relate to this, and then, you know, the kids or the baby get there, and you're like, I don't love all of this all the time. This is really hard. This is really challenging. I'm exhausted, and I know I wanted this little human, but man, I didn't want all of this, I don't think, and, you know, so the guilt kind of trickles in, and maybe some of the shame, or you know, some embarrassment that they would even feel that way. So when you're talking, I'm kind of reflecting back to moms that I know that struggled with infertility and finally get pregnant, maybe. Because I'll be honest, you are one of my first moms. That's why I was so excited to talk to you from the adoption experience. You know, I've worked with people from a professional standpoint, but my role with them was, you know, help the kid girl issues. You know, why is the toddler having tantrums? Why are they, you know, going to the bathroom in their room? But the parents didn't really get to share their side of it. And so, you know, looking back, I'm like, man, I wish I would have asked them, but that wasn't my role at that time, nor was I this experienced either. And so for you, could you relate to, I know you kind of talked about, you know, not feeling like, you know, you could maybe weigh in the same on the beginning, but how was the transition into like the day-to-day, right? The sleep exhaustion, you got two toddlers running around, you got a baby that's probably demanding. Did you experience any of that? Like, wow, this is really hard, maybe harder than I expected. Any Absolutely. Feelings like that? Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you where that came from, multiple directions. But one of them was the infant, when he came home, he was on a heart monitor. And so, because it's like just before we brought him home, he had been in a situation where he had stopped breathing and the foster mother had to revive him. And so they didn't find anything wrong with him in the multiple tests, but what they did was put him on a heart monitor. So when he transitioned to our home, at 2 months old, he had a heart monitor on. So can you imagine? And then I was working, because I went back to work after the first two. He came later, because he was kind of, you know, everybody has their surprise baby. He came later after I had gone back to work. And so I had to put him in daycare. And so you can imagine, I have to rely on daycare workers. They change shifts. Sometimes one person's not there. It's not consistent. And the stress of being at work and not knowing whether or not they're going to know how to operate the monitor, when it's an actual emergency, when it goes off on mistake, what to do, you know, all of those kinds of things. And, you know, through the night, it would go off all the time. And so you just lay awake waiting for an emergency. And then you have these other two toddlers that have boundless energy. And so sleep was, it didn't happen often because of those things. And then on the flip side of that was having this self-imposed, sometimes externally imposed, but self-imposed idea that because my children came to me differently than the average family, that I'm not going to have this innate motherly instinct. And as a result of that, I find myself asking people questions that I really, really know. And then I also have people giving me instructions as if I'm a complete idiot. And that because I did not give birth to my children, I can't possibly know how to do these things. There was just this struggle, this internal struggle, like, do I know what I'm doing? Is it possible for me to have this, you know, motherly instinct that they talk about? Does that only come when you give birth to your child? Just all of these things and this self-doubt as a result, you know, of how our family was, you know, came together. That was excruciating. That was very painful to go through. And I got through that eventually. And I recognized I have everything that I need to love, nurture, and parent the children that I've been blessed with. But at that time, I didn't recognize it. And I think that there were some people around me that didn't recognize it either.
People ask you, or what did you experience? I'm trying to get an idea, like, if I were in a room with you, what comments did you hear? What would people say?
They would try to give me advice on certain care tactics, or how to handle a tantrum, or how to, you know, feeding my kids, and just very basic everyday stuff. And I would get very defensive. And they would notice my defensiveness, and so that they would get, you know, an attitude. And these were close friends, but they felt like I was defensive and like I was acting like I knew everything. But I felt like I was being painted into a corner as if I didn't know anything. Sure. And that I needed everyone's help to raise my children. And I knew what I was doing. I innately had what I needed to parent them. But I had to give myself credit for that. And so when I was still very insecure about that, I found myself very defensive, and it caused issues.
Yeah. And I'm just kind of mulling over in my mind, you know, I think part of that, like you said, and I don't know, you know, one of the first things I tell people is I can't ever say shoulda, coulda, woulda. I'm right. Not in your situation. I'm not going to pretend to be in your situation. But I'm thinking, as a mom, that people do give you advice all the time, right? Whether you're biological mom, adoptive mom, foster mom, people are constantly giving advice, right? And man, yeah, lots of things, you know, have been said this way. And then I'm thinking, I'm sitting here guilty, like, man, I just did that three times this morning to friends. So, you know, I think part of it is part of that mom network of like, how can we help each other? But I think when you're kind of questioning yourself, it doesn't maybe feel like that at times. And I'm sure you know yourself and you know the people and you know whether they were just being helpful or kind of taking an educator role maybe versus a friend role, right?
Right.
You would know the difference. But I'm thinking, man, I just did that probably two or three times this morning already. one friend's baby's not sleeping. I'm like, have you tried Tylenol? She's like, girl, second baby. Yes, we've done the Tylenol, Motrin, Orajel. Yes, I've done it. What do you mean? I'm like, okay. I'm just, you know, thinking out loud with you. So one thing I was going to ask you, and this is going way back, but I didn't want to interrupt you. If you don't mind, if we can go back just a little bit. In my previous episodes, I interviewed a sonographer who works specifically in an infertility clinic right now. And I wanted to ask you, I know this is going way back, when you first started talking, you know, six miscarriages.
Seven.
Well, yeah. Seven.
Yeah.
Okay, six, because there's twins, right? You said?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you do any infertility type of treatment in regards to, you know, the hormones or anything like that? Because I know that's a whole nother area of stress and trial and, you know, appointments, yeah, etc.
We did very basic things through our OBGYN. Okay. By the time we had gotten, you know, really far and had multiple miscarriages, we decided that we were not going to move forward. And so our next step would have been to go to the next level, you know, infertility treatments and things of that nature. And that's where we stopped. We decided we weren't going to do that. We had already been through too much. My body had already been through too much. And that we were going to seek other routes.
Okay. And then my next question was, you know, I hear, so it was originally two kiddos at once that you knew, and I,
yes,
know, and if you could give our listeners a little bit of education, because I know some of this, but this, you know, you're a wealth of information with this. So from what I know, sibling sets and teenagers from the foster care adoption world are kind of the hardest, or, you know, maybe not hardest, but the groups or populations that typically are hardest to get placed. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And in specifically boys, yes.
Okay, so you originally thought taking on two, and I was gonna ask you, you know, did you come from a family of just like babysitting nieces and nephews? Were you like, we can tackle this because we, yeah, want kiddos and we have so much experience? Or were you just like, we know we want this and whatever comes?
Actually, at that time, I think I had a couple of nieces and nephews, but I'm from a big family, one of seven. None of my siblings lived in the city that I lived in. And so that kind of relationship really didn't happen often. None of my friends had children. At the time, we were all right out of college age. And so I didn't have a lot of experience with family and friends' children. However, right out of high school, I worked at a daycare. And for probably about a year before I went to college. And so that was my only experience with little ones, you know, infants and toddlers and things of that nature. I had a little bit experience. But I will say this, my goal going into college was to be an obstetrician gynecologist. And so just the desire to be surrounded by babies my whole life,
yeah,
was something that was there. And so even as a kid, I read a lot about childbirth, about all of the kinds of things that I would be doing in my future, which, you know, obviously did not happen. I changed route and everything. But so the passion was there. Basic knowledge was there, but not a lot of hands-on experience.
Yeah, and I asked that because I was personally reflecting, you know, preparing to interview you. And I actually, you don't know this, but I wrote a segment about myself and for the book, and then I took it out. I was like, that's for a different book, which you've encouraged me that, you know, this probably won't be my last. I don't know. We'll see. But but what I didn't include in my book was I started babysitting for my nieces and nephews at the age of 12. I had always either had nieces and nephews. Same with you. In high school, I started working at a daycare. And then, you know, I went into social work. So all my internships were related to kids. Like, my whole life was kids starting at 12. You know, I helped kind of co-parent my sister who came. I was 15 and she was born at that time. So I kind of took on a little bit of a parenting role. So when it came time to having kids, I was like in the bag. I used to babysit when I was 12. Like, I'm in my 30s. This is going to be a cakewalk. And then, as you know, and anybody that's read my book has known, it wasn't. It was so much harder than I would have ever anticipated. So I asked that more as a personal reflection of, like, yeah, kids were my thing. You know, I felt really comfortable. Was it a huge adjustment? Was it a, you know, did you experience that, ooh, this is, you know, not what I thought type of thing?
You know, absolutely. And I'll tell you this, I can only speak from being a mom of children that are adopted. That's my only experience. But I will say this, in the beginning, our goal was simply to be parents. And so we had no clue what trauma looked like. We had no clue how, you know, people will tell you, and the assumption is the younger they are adopted, the less trauma there is. You can't determine how someone responds to their life experiences. That's not something that is, you know, a boxed fact, right?
Sure.
And so we knew nothing. We knew nothing. We thought, you know, we have these two toddlers and an infant. It's early. Their experiences have been limited. And that's just not how it went down. And we had no clue what to expect. And when we began to see, you know, different behaviors and fears and just acting out as a result of the trauma, both in utero and after birth, that we recognized we didn't know much at all. And so we began to do our research. And when I say we, I did a lot of it, shared it with my husband. You know, and we determined how we were going to parent in certain situations that looked completely different than, you know, have a new child by Friday type books would tell you.
Sure.
It doesn't apply to children that have had adverse experiences. It just doesn't. And so I'm not a mom that can pick up an average parenting book off the shelf and get tips that help my kids. Very, very few are helpful, which is why I wrote a book myself. But
I was going to say, now, is that why you know, wrote your own books? Because just nothing, right? The shelves are just like, okay,
right,
that's great, but doesn't apply.
Right.
You know, not going to work here.
Exactly. And so some of the things that, you know, a parent that is parenting children has not experienced, you know, adverse events in their life, may be able to use those tips and tricks or whatever, you know, the book is telling you. But when you have a child that has experienced trauma in multiple ways, you have to, it is counterintuitive. The things that someone else would tell you to do actually, in some cases, instill more fear of abandonment and abuse. And so you have to think differently. And we were learning that. So we, you know, moving forward, we had our older three children for 7 years before we thought, hey, let's do this again. And again, we were the only family waiting for three or more children. At one point, we were looking at a sibling group of five. But we were very excited when we brought the second sibling group home. They were 6, 5, and 3. And at this point, we knew a whole lot more I had been traveling and I had a radio podcast on foster care adoption and trauma competent parenting, all those kinds of things. So I knew a whole lot more. I understood what was going to be required of us as parents. We had a plan, we had strategy, we had the compassion that we needed to deal with whatever came. And so at that time, the older three were 10, 9, and 6, I believe. Or 9, 8, and 6. I can't remember. But and then we brought three more children home. So we had 6 children under 9.
Yep. I did the math there in my head.
Right. And if you can imagine, the beginning was just heaven. It was like, oh my gosh, the older three had 3 new playmates, right? And but not very long after, because we were house number 6 for these three, and so that meant a lot of experiences, a lot of adverse, you know, events happening in their short lives that we had to now uncover and walk through healing, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And you've had experience with children that have had these challenges and these experiences, so I know you know what I'm talking about. But it became a situation where my youngest was trumped 3 times, and so he went from being the baby to being a big brother of 3 children. And that was challenging, and I blamed myself for it. There were other challenges that you know, between sibling groups, that was very hard to deal with, and us versus them, we were here first. Just it was really challenging. And so as a result of it not looking like I always dreamed, and you know, backing up to my husband and I, before we even got married 24 years ago, we wanted 6 children. We have 6 children now. The pitter patter feet and the laughter and the excitement and the large family gatherings, I mean, that's what we always dreamed of, and we have that now. But at that time, you know, the honeymoon was very short, because a lot of the challenges that our younger three had experienced, we had to deal with. And it made things not look like the typical family. And so that was hard. And so that brought literally what I would consider, or many call, post-adoption blues or post-adoption depression. Where it didn't, my big happy family didn't look like what I wanted it to look like. And it was excruciatingly painful to admit that. So that was a very, very challenging time for me. And it felt familiar from before, but like on steroids.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, it was a whole different level that we were experiencing in the way that we had to parent, and the compassion that we had to have, and the decisions that we had to make for, you know, our household that looked completely, you know, possibly ridiculous to someone on the outside that doesn't understand the dynamics and the care that we have to take with our kids as a result of their experiences. And so it's, you know, here we are. They came home in 2013, the second sibling group. And here we are almost 9 years later. And we are a happy, loving family. We have our, you know, we have our issues like any other family, sibling rivalry, all that basic stuff. But it took time to get there. And I think that, you know, for anybody listening, whether it's through, you know, foster care, adoption, whether it's through, you know, childbirth, you have to give yourself time. And you have to give yourself and your family the credit for being, for having what you need to succeed and get past the hard stuff. Sometimes you need help doing that with wonderful people like yourself. Sometimes, you know, it's about supporting each other through the hard things. But for the most part, we've done that and we've worked through things and we've been a family that talks and hashes things out and loves on each other and makes sure that we're each other's number one cheerleader. And that came from the hard work, but it didn't start there. You know, so any issues that a mom is going through, any situations that come as a result of parenting that were completely unexpected, it takes time. And you have to give yourself grace. You have to give your family, your husband grace. You have to give your children grace for simply being children. And just know that it's a station, but it's not the last stop. Things don't have to stay that way. You, your family members can get the help that they need if that is necessary, and move forward in a way that that you can function together as a unit. So, I mean, I didn't plan to go there, but I just wanted people to know it has not been easy. You know, we have these we have these beautiful family portraits. No one knows all the work and the compassion and the prayer and all the things that have to go into growing and healing and moving forward, you know, through hard stuff.
Sure.
You know,
go ahead.
Nothing just happens overnight. You know, and it will continue to be hard if you don't work at it, or you don't, or you ignore it, or you pretend it doesn't exist.
So I wanted to break down into two, because I had two thoughts as you're sharing all this. And so the first thought that you and I have talked about, but I just want to kind of slide in for an education piece, as you referred to, you know, the post-adoption, I believe you called it, or post-adoption blues.
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of people don't realize, and you and I have talked about this, is that, you know, adoptive parents, foster parents can also have postpartum mood disorders. So mm-hmm. depression, postpartum anxiety. And I was recently talking to somebody and they're like, well, can't only moms have that? Can't only the biological moms have that? Isn't it just a hormonal thing? And it's not just a hormonal thing. So any caregiver, parent, anybody that is responsible for the basic needs of the child can be diagnosed with a postpartum mood disorder. And that's important for people to know because it kind of helps be inclusive.
Yeah, you don't feel crazy.
Right, right. Yep, because then there's parents experiencing this and they're like, but wait, I thought only, you know, I'm not the biological parents. Like, yeah, it doesn't. What it is, it's a huge adjustment for everybody. It doesn't matter how you're related to the baby. It's a huge adjustment, and that's the biggest thing. It's the sleep deprivation, you know. And sure, there's a hormonal component for the mom because, you know, hormones are changing, but that isn't, you know, the sole basis of criteria. So I just wanted to put that in there that any, you know, because I know that, you know, family members might take in a new baby, so they might not be classified as, you know, adoptive parent or foster parent. Maybe they're considered guardian, and they can have it, you know, and they're like, well, I'm grandma. And it's like, you are, but you're also the sole person taking care of this little human, and it's tough. So you might be anxious. And, you know, I thought about you, and I'm not diagnosing you or anything, but as soon as, you know, the reason why I wrote my book was because of my postpartum anxiety was so severe. So when you were talking earlier about your son with the heart monitor and being at daycare, and I was thinking, oh Lord, I don't know if I could have done it. I thought something was going to happen to her without a heart monitor, you know? Mm-hmm. So when you said that, I was like, I could see how, again, not diagnosing you, but if you had a postpartum anxiety, I would be like, yep, understandable. You're going to work and you're putting your faith that these providers are on and paying attention and listen to your education that you gave them. And like you said, know the different beeps and know what this means and what's an emergency. And so I could see any, you know, new parent that kind of, you know, exhibiting some anxiety, you know, reasonably so. That's a tall order.
If you think about those things as well, my anxiety was also, I was still had a little bit of the idea in my mind that my miscarriages were my fault. And so moving forward, I need to keep these kids alive.
Yeah.
I need to keep these kids safe. So there was this anxiety, you know, that I have to fight even today, that I have to make sure that they're okay. It's my response, you know, it's like taking on this impossible task.
Yeah. Of
absolute 100%, 24 hours a day care that really is impossible for any human. But in my mind, I failed before, so I have to get this right. So when something's going wrong, it must be my fault. That's a lot to handle. That's a lot to put on yourself. And so I had to grapple with all of those thoughts. I'm just so thankful for my husband. He talks me off a cliff so many times throughout this entire parenting journey when I'm just losing it. And it happens less and less. I'm much more confident today than I was back then. But it takes root in those early losses.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to continue to talk to myself and make sure that, you know, that had nothing to do with anything that you did. You know, your body just didn't want to cooperate. And that's the story. That's the truth. And but it's just really interesting to be able to to be able to have those conversations and acknowledge, you know, truth versus anxiety and fear.
Yeah. And it's hard to do.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Six times over.
Well, and I've, you know, said in other episodes, right? And you would have experienced this. You take the babies, you take the kids to the checkup, and you're given a handout, you know, to go home, which is basically your to-do list of how to keep them alive, which is essentially don't let them move and let them only eat soft food, right? Like by the time you look at that list, it's like, don't let them move too much and eat soft food. So you're kind of predisposed to be heightened of all the things that are dangers, right? That whole list. If you're a parent that actually reads like all the recommendations that come on that follow-up, is like, oh, okay.
So and that never ends. Like, yeah. I have a 19-year-old and I'm like, okay, what is my role in her life right now?
Sure. Yep. So while we have a little bit of time, because this is where you have to take over, Carla. This is all you and your experience. And yes, I know a little bit, but this is going to be you. So when I was listening to you talk about, like, you know, the sibling sets coming home and the challenges and the behaviors, what did that look like? And I respect, you know, it, you know, what you're comfortable sharing and what you're not, but I know that I even have friends that have considered like foster care and adoption. Could you give it a real, you know, because I'm all about keeping it real, could you kind of paint us a picture of like what behaviors might somebody see for kids that have trauma, you know, more specifically with the toddler ages, if you don't mind? Mm-hmm. What could somebody maybe expect? I know all kids are different, all experiences are different, but what were some commonalities, or when you're talking internationally, globally, giving training behaviors that might stick out more as trauma behaviors versus like this toddler's just having a tantrum type of thing? Does that make sense?
Right. Okay. So I'm really tight-lipped about my kids' story. So I'll try to paint a generic picture here.
Sure.
Again, I've been across the world. And one thing that I have noticed, our parents are parents. children are children. And every parent that I've come in contact with, whether it's here, whether it's in Malawi or Thailand or Abu Dhabi or wherever I happen to be at that time, those, the keys that parent, you know, what parents want for their kids is the same: to be happy, to be healthy, and to thrive, you know, in life, and to be safe. And what I have noticed across the board is that everyone responds to their trauma differently. And so you cannot have a box that says this is trauma and this is not. Although it's important to be able to distinguish that, to know how you need to act and help your child through that healing process. But it's all rooted in fear. And so you could see, basic example, I've known a child that was afraid of showers. And the only way we knew why that took place is by reading the paperwork and asking questions of former foster families. And that was because one of the homes that that child was in punished that child with cold showers. And so what would be a normal action would be a fear trigger for someone else. So it depends on, you know, the experiences of that child, what they've been exposed to. A lot of times you can see in their play and through the fears that they exhibit, the kinds of things that they've been exposed to, that will kind of help you know, where your child needs help and assistance. I will give you another example. I mentioned that my youngest three, we were their sixth home. Now, mind you, they were 6, 5, and 3. So you can imagine, you know, being three, that's like 2 homes average a year, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of disconnect, emotional disconnect that you have to work through, because no one has ever connected. And so now when you say this is your last stop, you're not going anywhere else. Come hell or high water, you're here. We're here for you. You're part of this family. Nothing's going to happen to you. No matter what choice you make, we're not going to say, oh, move on to the next family. That's not how this works. But you can't convince a child that has been in that experience to be convinced of that, because everywhere they went was the last stop. So that takes time to build that trust and to build that relationship in a child that has never had someone build that relationship. And so there are walls and there are fears. An example, one of my children waited about a year before she decided to ask me to put her suitcase in the basement. It sat right next to her bed.
Sure.
Because this is my sixth home. Will there be a seventh? I know you told me that this was the last stop, but how can I be so sure? And the day that she asked me to put her suitcase in the basement was a breakthrough.
Yeah.
She knew, number one, at that time, she had been in our house longer than anywhere else she had been in her life. And so that was a breakthrough day. That was a day she had decided in her heart and her mind that she accepted this was her new family. This was her safe place. And that was major. That doesn't mean that all other fears and everything went away. It just means that was a step in the right direction. And sometimes we have to allow our kids to heal in a way that makes sense and works for them. And it may look completely different. You may find yourself doing things that other parents don't have to do. Like, for instance, remind your children that you're going to be there in the morning. Most biological parents don't have to do that. But very early on, I had to remind my kids, I'll be here in the morning. You won't be somewhere else. No one's coming to take you. I will be here in the morning. And so it's all fear related. It comes in multiple forms. But parents that are considering, you know, foster care and adoption, they have to recognize there's going to be some things logistically in their life that have to change and be rearranged to be able to meet the needs of kids that have had experiences that cause what they would consider irrational fears. And so, you know, these are the things that I teach to foster and adoptive families all over the world. And I have an entire curriculum, you know, that I've developed, but it's just important to recognize that you have to hone in on each individual child, what their fears are and what their needs are, because they're all different. And what scares one does not scare another. What's important to one is not important to another. And so that's been the most important thing, is that you do not approach it with a boxed, you know, prefabricated idea of how to handle things, because it's going to be different with each kid. And as you approach it differently with each kid, you'll build that relationship that that is unique to both of you. So hopefully that was helpful.
Well, and I'm thinking, I'm like, I want to attend one of your trainings. So if somebody is kind of, you know, interested and maybe toying with the idea, is there a way, how would somebody, or even me, how could we attend one of your trainings just to get more information, just to kind of see what your experience has been? Because I know I want to be respectful of your time, and there's no way we could ever cover everything in your curriculum. How could we do that? How would somebody get in contact or attend one of your trainings?
Okay, well, that's a very good question. Most of the trainings that I do are as a result of conferences and churches and organizations bringing me in to speak to their group of people, or to, you know, a conference of attendees. And so I don't necessarily have trainings of my own, although I do plan on doing some of those when the world kind of changes a little bit.
Sure.
But if anyone is interested in scheduling a training for themselves and a group of parents, then they can contact me on my website, which is Carla with a K, CarlaMarieWilliams.com. They can contact me through the website and determine, you know, what it is that they want me to share, whether or not it's a keynote, whether or not it's an actual workshop or training, that kind of thing. And then we can go from there.
Okay. That's perfect. And then also, you have 8 books currently, and I know you got many more in the making.
Yes.
What is the best way for people to find you and to find your books? Because, you know, let's say maybe a training is going to be on hold, or maybe they're unsure but kind of want to read what you've written. What's the best way to find all your books?
Okay, so all of my books can be found on Amazon under Carla, again, Carla with a K, Carla Marie Williams. But the best way to do it is to go through my website, CarlaMarieWilliams.com. Everything that I do is there. Everything that I've done in the past is there. all of my books are there. They can access the courses that I have. They can access. And so I think that that would be the best way for them to get in touch with me. Now, my books are not all on the topics that we've talked about today. They're anywhere from homeschooling, travel, foster care and adoption, trauma competent parenting. I have a type of memoir called Let Go, A Control Freak's Fight for Peace. That's one of my best sellers. And as well as a Christian Living, there's a prayer book. So there's lots of different books, but I will say they're all for moms. That's my heart. Moms are who I focus all of my attention on. And so they can go there and check out and see which ones fit what they're looking for. And also one on marriage. So lots of different goodies. And I will say this, that all of my books are on sale for $10 until December 31st. And so if they want to pick up, you know, some goodies for themselves or friends, now would be a good time to do that before January 1st.
Yeah, I'm going to have to pick up Let Go. I went to the doctor today. She told me to up my Zoloft to 25 milligrams. She's like, I know you're doing 12.5 right now, but you might want to. I was like, okay, fair enough. Fair enough. I'll do that. All right. In closing, I have three questions that I ask every person that I interview. So in general, just as a mom, what has been most supportive to you?
My husband. He has been my rock. Anytime things are difficult, one thing I can know for sure is that he and I are a team. It's us against the issue, not us against each other. And I just really appreciate, you know, his level of support, his family, and to myself and my dreams. And it's really, it's a godsend to have him be so supportive and helpful when I struggle.
And well, Andy is Superman, so you have that.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. What do you do today to take care of yourself as a mom?
Well, I have a daily bubble bath.
Yeah. Yes, that's wonderful.
Yes, I do. And you know what? It just calms me. Sometimes it's in the morning, sometimes it's at night, but it's always during a quiet time where I can just listen to my music and pray and just relax and be quiet. What it does, it helps me come down from stressful days. It helps me prepare for days that may be busy ahead. And it's, you know, it's soothing. So I feel like that's my moment, my time. I always make sure that I have time for friends, that I allow myself to spend time with friends that are really uplifting. And so, you know, just to get away from the everyday, and even if it's just for a couple hours for tea or something like that. I love nature. I love, you know, walking in nature and being surrounded by nature and things of that nature. I love travel. I know that's a little expensive, and I haven't been able to do a lot of that the last 2 years, but that's something to me is self-care, because I'm very passionate about, you know, about learning other cultures and things of that nature. But mainly it's just being kind to myself.
Go ahead.
I feel like moms, we're not kind to ourselves. We spend more time criticizing ourselves than we are giving ourselves grace and compassion. We have compassion for other people. We're kind to other people. But sometimes we need to show that same kindness and compassion to ourselves. And I'm learning how to do that. I'm not an expert at it yet, but I'm learning how to do that. And it's helpful.
Well, and I was going to say that kind of leads me to my third question, but you might have a different answer for this. I was going to say, what advice would you have for a listener? But knowing that your passion is moms, what advice would you have for any mom out there?
I would say that you are the mom that your children need, and you need to be convinced of that and recognize that you're doing a really great job. And any areas in which you want to improve, you have the power to do that. And so don't feel like any situation is helpless or hopeless. We have the ability as moms to set the standard and the environment in our home. And anything that we want to change, we can change it. And that we can be who we want to be as moms, who we want to be as wives. You just have to be kind to yourself, give yourself time, and give yourself compassion, like I said before, in order to see those things happen. You can't stay in a state of criticism of yourselves and everything that you do and see the changes that you want to see happen in your home.
I love that. I'm so excited to read, you know, some more of your books. And I think it'd be, you know, like you said, there's a variety of topics. I think Momspiration is one, would you say, that any mom could relate to? So kind of put that, you guys, on your radar to read.
Absolutely.
And Carla, I am so thankful for you, not just, you know, for this interview, but for your knowledge, for helping me. I kind of came to you, help me, I don't know where to go from here. And you have been so wonderful. And I'm almost at 100 books sold. So I do credit. I know. I credit that to you. You know, obviously I put the words on the page, but as you know, nobody writes a book alone. You have a whole team behind you, and you are a huge motivator for that. So I'm very thankful for you. To our listeners, thank you for listening. Please visit Carla's website. There is so much on there. She is such a wonderful person. Her family is wonderful. If you're interested in writing your own book, she does have a self-publishing boot camp that you could check out as well. We didn't touch on that, and I wanted to. So thank you so much, Carla. Have a good New Year's. Thank you for your time. Tune. We have more interviews coming up in the next few weeks.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Bye, everyone.